This is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
All right, so welcome everyone to our second episode. I'm Ben Simon, and I've got with me today Dr. Yanni Giertsema, who's a child and adolescent psychiatrist and consultation liaison psychiatrist at Lady Cilento Children's Hospital. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Yanni, I want to kind of do a narrow but deep dive into a very specific topic today, which is we have heard a lot of stories over the last 24 hours at Don't Forget the Bubbles about the importance of story and human connection and maintaining empathy with people. We haven't had much of a conversation about why we don't do that. And I think for me, one of the big barriers in my clinical practice, in my educational practice, in connecting honestly with someone, is that we get defensive. You know, we say we want feedback, but then we get upset when we get it. We say we're trying to help the parents, but we don't necessarily listen. We get frustrated when they seem to not take in what we're telling them. And so I'm wondering if we can just break that down over the next 20 minutes or so. So to start with, from like a really basic, it's very simplified level, why do we get defensive?
Well, thanks for that, Ben. I have to say I'm quite amused by Ben being curious about psychiatry, because most of the pediatricians I know want to get as far away from it as possible. So as I was sitting there, I just realised that I'm going to go off script a bit, Ben. And, and I think what I've realised is, I think to some degree at least, it's dishonest to think about feelings. Whereas what we really should be doing is to think about the psychological energy that's embedded in that feeling. So I think that's a huge difference. Mm-hmm. It's much harder work. It's not so much about just neutralizing feelings. It's about digesting toxic affect that comes with that. And that is no joke. That is really hard work. So why do we get defensive? I think Professor Irvin Yalom at the University of Stanford did a longitudinal study over 30 years where he asked people what their biggest fear was, and most of us have a deep-seated conviction or belief that we just don't have what it takes and that we're essentially faking our way through life. And that certainly resonates with me. Maybe that's why I became a psychiatrist. So I guess what I'm saying is that when things go wrong at work, there would be this negative attribution bias where we think, you know, it's my fault because I don't know what I'm doing. And then furthermore, I think how we see ourselves is trapped between primitive fears and urges and society's expectations of how we should be behaving. And that is very difficult. That's a difficult place to sit in.
So if I can just recap that. So we get defensive sometimes because we have this quite universal sense of inadequacy, mm-hmm. or what we would call in clinical practice, we often refer to as imposter syndrome. Mm. And we kind of have these two parts of our brain, a primitive part that has sort of some very evolutionary urges. And then we have kind of society, the part of us that's created by society and our upbringing and our own expectations that we probably identify as us. There's tension between those two things. And you've mentioned to me before this idea that defensiveness is not a character flaw, that it's actually psychological homeostasis, that it's actually there to protect our sense of self.
Yes, that's right. So in psychiatry, we like to think of our sense of self as how we see ourselves and how we're sitting in the world. And that's no easy thing, right? Because we've got these ancient parts of our brain where we're very strong impulses, urges, and feelings like aggression and violence is held, and then these unreasonable expectations that society have of us, where it's just not okay to scream and to hit people and to murder disturbed mums. So in between all of that is our sense of self, and through thousands of years, psychological mechanisms has developed to protect our sense of self. And if we lose those, if we lose our sense of self, we go crazy. So the stakes are high.
And I think for me what's helped me is kind of stopping thinking about psyche as not being part of the body. And if I think of my sense of self as an organ that is just as important mm-hmm. as my brain or my heart, then actually getting defensive is kind of a natural process in making sure I don't lose that organ, and that actually really helps me.
Yeah, I think you could see it of it. You could look at it as a sign of health and not as a sign of disturbedness.
Yep. So I want to just unpack defensive mechanisms. And so one thing that you've taught me in the past, Stuart, if you're able to bring up the slide, is this concept of the triangle of conflict, about why we show defense mechanisms or why we engage in defense mechanisms. And so from what you've taught me, it's kind of 3 points of this triangle, but essentially we all experience often emotions that we, or feelings or thoughts that we can't express in the moment. And we have an understandable, logical anxiety about the consequences that would happen if we express them. Mm. Yeah? And so reframing a defense mechanism as actually our immune system's intervention to stop that thing happening and to protect us is essentially what happens. Is that kind of, have I got it?
Yeah, sort of. I think the, so for example, the... Well, these are complicated things, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I get it.
Yeah.
We're trying to figure it out together,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So say, for example, there's this fury, there's this sense of incredible hatred that you
I
have.
I just wanted you to say yes.
Yes, yes.
So I am I am going to just, not to get defensive, yeah. but...
Me too.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you can just come with me in that triangle, and if we just unpack quickly two examples. And I've got one, you've got one, we're going to share together. So mine is when I did my adult emergency year, I spent some time in recess where it felt like every second patient was a highly activated, abusive methamphetamine user who I was giving droperidol to. Yeah. And as a pediatrician, that was just a really new, frustrating, irritating experience. Yeah. And so I kept my cool, and then one day as I was going home, I walked in the front door, tripped on the vacuum cleaner, and then I turned around, and I kid you not, in that moment, I hated that vacuum cleaner, right? And I kicked it really hard, and then I turned around, my sister caught me. And she looked at me like I was the craziest mofo she had ever seen. You know. So, am I crazy?
Obviously.
Yeah. Mic drop.
No, psychiatrists like to give names to things because when we can name it, we can grip them and deal with it. We would call that projection. Oh, yep. No, displacement, actually.
Yep. Displacement.
So what that means is that you've taken the psychological energy that was embedded in the feeling of aggression and hatred, you set it aside for later when it would have been helpful to get rid of that energy,
mm-hmm.
And then you discharge it of it appropriately.
So you, yep. So you held it because you couldn't express it in that moment, carried it home, let it out on an inanimate object where it's actually safe.
What would you have done if you did that in emergency? What would have happened?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been good. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So if we unpack that on our triangle, we had the hidden feeling, which I guess is anger and frustration at a patient. We had an anxiety, which is that I couldn't express that at work. I'd lose my license. I'd be in big trouble. Lose my job. Destroy my family. Yeah?
Yep.
So my defense in that time was displacement. Bottled it up. Carried it home, let it out.
That's right.
Okay. I think you've got a really... Would you say that's a good or a bad thing?
Well, in psychiatry, there's no such thing as good or bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll talk about that a little bit later. We'll talk about adaptive and maladaptive strategies, which is, I think, a very important idea, but not easy to understand.
Okay.
So the example that I want to use is in my days of being a proper doctor. I worked with in theatre, and I was a theatre assistant. And it happened very often that when something went very badly wrong in surgery, and I was the assistant, I got blamed for it. And the surgeon would stand back, and they'd scream at the top of their voice that I'm a useless assistant, and that's why the patient's bleeding to death. So that's, you know, maybe a less healthy defense, but still necessary,
mm-hmm.
to get the job done in that moment of hotness.
Yeah, So we mentioned that there are different names for this.
Yep.
Different defense mechanisms that we use, and we're not going to go through all of them, but my understanding would be this would be projection.
That's right.
Yeah. So the surgeon has taken an anxiety or a hidden feeling, which is going to be, I've messed up, this patient might die, and I'm a bad surgeon, potentially.
Yep.
The anxiety of exposure of that feeling is that, again, there's huge professional consequence, there's consequence to the patient. And so in that moment, they've used the defense mechanism and they've taken that feeling of inadequacy and thrown it on you.
Correct.
So what is really interesting about this example is that even though that sounds like a really negative experience for you, would you call this adaptive or maladaptive?
Well, you see, that just illustrates the importance of it being homeostasis of some sort. I would argue that that's not the time for the surgeon to have deep emotional insight to realise that they maybe shouldn't be doing surgery. That's not the right time. That's not the right time for that level of insight. That's strike when the iron is cold. But at that moment, what needs to be done is the bleeding needs to be stopped. And regardless of what the psychological mechanism is, get the job done. So I'm saying that it's a good thing in that it helps the surgeon stopping the bleeding, but it's not so good in that it's going to harm the surgeon's reputation because people are going to start saying, if this happens all the time, he's an idiot. And it's certainly going to affect you because you're not going to like him because he does that, and it's certainly going to affect your own sense of self. So in that sense, I would argue that it's maladaptive.
Okay. So if we can just paraphrase, and I know this is killing you because it's oversimplifying, but adaptive is essentially going to be if we use the defense mechanism and it helps us and it helps the people around us.
Yes.
And if we're really super reductionist, a maladaptive one is going to be one that doesn't help us or ends up entrenching behaviours that make things worse.
Yes.
Or worse for the people around us.
That's right.
And you can be both. That example's kind of both. It's actually adaptive if you're taking the stance of the patient.
Mm.
It's maladaptive if we're taking the stance of you as the assistant.
Yep.
And I think for me, just understanding that complexity makes it easier for me to not judge that surgeon as harshly in that moment.
Mm.
You know? One of the things that you also taught me, which I really love, is this concept of the wish to reveal and the wish to conceal.
Mm.
Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah. So in psychiatry, all behaviours are a communication of some sort because you have to understand this. Thoughts and feelings are ancient. It's thousands of years old. Thoughts are perhaps not that old, but the semantic representation of internal feeling states, in other words, language, is a fairly recent development. And because we as humans are pack animals and we exist in groups, the defense mechanisms is designed, on the one hand, to avoid pain, but on the other hand, it's also designed as a communication of some sorts to show to our colleagues that I'm really bleeding here psychologically,
mm-hmm.
and I really need your assistance because this isn't going well for me.
Yeah, and I think you gave me a great example once of passive aggression. And so you'd said in another talk that if I'm feeling frustrated because I don't want to go to this meeting because I think the meeting is crap and I don't agree with the outcomes of it, but I have to go because that's the expectation, if I then turn up late, I don't have to own that I object to the meeting, so I've protected that anxiety of not doing the right thing in my workplace.
Mm.
But everybody else in that meeting is now angry and frustrated just like me.
Mm.
So I've actually successfully communicated the emotion that I'm feeling, even if I haven't communicated the specifics.
Yes,
yeah?
That's right.
And that to me is like the key to the universe.
Yes.
Yeah? because if... when we're in sim and we're debriefing or we run like a two-day course and we're trying to give each other feedback, you feel this pushback. And, you know, we ask for feedback, we ask to be in a learning situation, but then we get feedback and it hurts, yeah? And actually, I think what's helped me with that is if I can look into that as a communication, if I can take that defensive behavior, whatever it is, if it's passive aggression, if it's displacement, if they're angry about what was on for morning tea, and instead take that as a communication that person's distressed,
mm.
then maybe that will help me reconnect better than if I take the kind of judgy approach where I go, well, that person doesn't have a very good growth mindset, or, you know, they're just not open. They said they wanted feedback, but they didn't. They're a dick, right? That's not actually true. This is just normal and universal, and we all do it all the time. You know? So in our last 5 minutes, I guess I want to just ask you, now that we've kind of unpacked that as a mechanism and sort of given us some structure to understand the basics of why we get defensive, when we experience someone in that moment, how do we help them rather than escalate things? Just in 5 minutes, you could just solve that problem.
Well, what do you say to that? I think an important rule in psychiatry, again, is that things are never so bad that it can't get worse. I think that's true. And the worst thing to do when someone is regressed, dysregulated, bleeding emotionally, is to point out their deficits to them and say, well, I've got some feedback for you. You shouldn't be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the right time. Again, strike when the iron is cold. I think to see that as a communication, and then to address that when the time is right, I don't like the word either, in a safe space, but maybe what I mean by that is different from, you know, from what other people mean, and I'm happy to talk about that a little bit. To address that and to see that as a communication, I think is of key importance.
Mm. And I think we've still got sort of a few minutes. So if I can contextualize that to a critical care and to an educational perspective.
Mm.
From an educational perspective, we talked in the last talk a lot about psychological safety. And to me, I think actually what we're trying to do is take away that rightward point on the triangle, that anxiety of exposure, of what if people found out what I was actually thinking or what I was actually doing, so that defense mechanism doesn't have to come in and protect our sense of self.
Mm.
Yeah? I don't think we're very good at that in critical care.
Mm.
And I think that we're in an activated state and we're actually exposed to a huge amount of complex emotions all of the time.
Mm.
And we don't have the words to process it right. And so we go home and we take it out on our spouse, or we, you know, find some other way to express it, because we don't even really understand from a basic level what's going on with us.
Mm.
We're kind of starting to do that with critical incident debriefing and things. Mm. But what do you guys do in psych?
Well, my experience of debrief has been simply that we sat in a group and then we all sort of thought about it a little bit, and then we decided, okay, everyone's feeling better now, let's go and do some real resources again, which I don't think is a good idea of thinking about it. In psychiatry, there's different levels of intervention depending on the different levels of distress and the different levels of psychological sophistication required.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that feelings are not just about touchy-feely, singing kumbaya sort of thing. I think feelings are really powerful, difficult things to understand. They're even harder to detoxify and to articulate appropriately. And that's no joke. That is hard psychological work that needs to be done when the time is right by the people who know how to address that sort of thing. In psych, we distinguish between debrief, mentorship, individual supervision, group supervision, and then therapy for ourselves. And each of these have a different level of surgical depth that's used to dissect the underlying reasons why these feelings are so powerful and all-powerful over us sometimes.
Yeah. And I think for me, learning in psych, when I did the psych term with you, was that finding out that supervision is not about me learning about psychiatry. It's learning about what the emotions of my experience with my patients actually brings out in me, and how I experience that, really important.
Yes.
And I think we need to work out as a community how we're going to do that in critical care.
Before we run out of time, I want to say this. I think it's such an important thing to develop insight, which means to understand who you are, what you bring to the consultation, and how you sit in the world, and how you affect the people around you. And that's no joke. That's very difficult to do. And when you've got that, the first step to good judgment is having good insight. And we all know that good medicine is all about good judgment, right? So this is very important.
Great. So I'm just going to close there and summarize. So defense mechanisms aren't character flaws. They're universal, and you can kind of think about them as an immune system for your sense of self or a psychological homeostasis. Yeah? We use them to protect ourselves from the consequences or the feared consequences of unexpressed emotion. And sometimes the defense mechanism that we choose actually conveniently also expresses the thing that we're dying to express, even as we protest that it's not. Yeah? And so I think our journey, when we're experiencing patients, families, staff, colleagues who are experienced or who are demonstrating defensive behaviors, is to hopefully take that little point off the triangle and understand that that's okay and accept them and understand that at a later time you might be able to have a different conversation.
You got it, Ben.
Great. So we might open the floor up to some questions.
Thank you both. I suspect that I'm going to be watching that presentation many, many times online and still be unpacking and learning from it. Ben, I think it was inevitable that you would take out your frustration on an inanimate object. It's usually called nature abhors a vacuum. thank you. Heading over to Twitter now and see what questions we've got.
So Casey agrees with Ian and thinks that taking your angst out on a vacuum cleaner sucks. but Shabs would like to know, in your experience, Yanni, how do you and your colleagues balance imposter syndrome and being unconsciously incompetent as health professionals?
Can you tell that story?
Which one?
The three nights?
Yeah, I think the... Well, firstly, there's some Professor Irvin Yalom at the University of Stanford. He, over 30 years of doing group therapy with doctors who wants to be psychiatrists, and I hope I'm not going to lose my job when I say this, but psychiatrists do psychiatry because we have to, right?
We can edit that out.
Yep. Yeah. So what he found there in that group was that most people have a deep sense of not being good enough and being a fraud. And I think that's a very important thing to acknowledge and to look at and to identify, because if we can name it, then we can work with it and we can think, well, is that really the case and why is it that you feel that way and how does that impact your work? And maybe we could reframe that and repackage that in a more helpful, more adaptive way.
So we might go to the floor if that's okay. And we've probably only got time for about one more minute. So if your question is able to be solved with a number or something similar, please go ahead.
I would say that we're not really, all of us have a very little ability to interpret someone's emotions.
Mm. But there are some good resources. Babette Rothschild's book has got a superb chart within it. I'm sure you're familiar with it, that describes the grades of people's feelings. She puts it into seven categories of arousal and points out that actually it's quite readable, you know, when you look at the different states of arousals, but we're not taught it. Mm. So we're often faced with people and we're not really quite sure of their level of arousal, so we behave inappropriately. Mm. But it actually is quite a teachable thing to recognise levels of arousal. I just wondered what you thought about the deliberate teaching of that.
I think that's an excellent idea. I think that's, you know, that's such a helpful thing. And even though we can identify intellectually what different levels of arousal is, but what I think we're also very good at is on a very intuitive gut feeling level to know that there's something just not right and that there's something going on here that's above and beyond what rational, measurable facts are showing. But certainly, I mean, the better we are at naming things, the better we are at dealing with them. So I think that's an excellent idea.
If I can follow that up, though, I think one thing that I've reflected on learning this stuff is even when you understand it, it's really hard to stay calm in the moment. Like, you can feel your frontal lobe just burning, trying to let that person express that behaviour without escalating yourself.
Quite nicely, within that diagram, there's kind of a solution for each level that helps guide us, perhaps, you know, that this is one you should not touch, this is one where you should be giving sympathy, yeah. This is one where whatever.
Thank you.
I think we will have to wrap up for the sake of time and to allow the next of the speakers to come across. Thank you again to both Yanni and to Ben as well. Could we please give them a round of applause?